You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up, a case at the U.S. Supreme Court next term will determine whether people with domestic violence restraining orders will have the right to own guns. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a piece of art called The Land of the Freed Up Woman.
The 1970s were the height of the second wave of feminism, when women in the U.S. were advocating for equal rights and opportunities to men. As Molly Honkin tells us, it was during this time that one woman expressed her feminist views by creating art made out of a unique medium, bras.
Artist Marge Engelman has spent much of her life in Wisconsin. The walls of her Madison apartment reflect that time, as they're covered with countless pieces of art.
This is Twinkle, Twinkle, Little Star. The Big Bear. Anyway, I'll show you around.
Despite Engelman's own works of art that currently adorn her apartment's walls, she says she wasn't always an artist.
When I was in grade school, a teacher had implied that I did not have artistic ability. So I took that seriously.
Engelman says she never visited art galleries until she was 38, and she definitely didn't make her own art. That changed when she discovered that the University of Wisconsin Extension offered courses in contemporary art.
I found out there was a program in the School of Home Economics, and it was called Related Art. So I registered. I was about 48 years old, so I was a different kind of student.
Through this program, Engelman got her master's degree in art after 2 years. She taught introductory art courses for a few years and was then appointed as the director of outreach at UW-Green Bay. Engelman says around this time, change was taking root.
The feminist movement came along, and I became a flaming feminist because I felt quite a bit of discrimination growing up and also working, because women weren't valued as much as men.
Engelman says she was inspired by this moment. It led her to start a child care center on UW-Green Bay's campus for students and faculty. Plus, she was still creating art, including a historical piece she created in 1971 that was inspired by the bra-burning feminists.
But then it was about that time that I got the idea for the bra banner, and I called it the Land of the Freed Up Woman.
The banner looks like the American flag, but features stripes made out of red velveteen and 20 white padded bras. It also alters the stars in the corner of the flag by replacing them with foam modeled after birth control pills.
The pill, a contraceptive pill, had just come out, and so I decided I could visualize that in the field of blue.
She created the flag in response to her experiences with discrimination. During her time in administration at UW-Green Bay, Engelman says she was the only woman on staff.
There were things that were said to me and opportunities I didn't have because I was a woman. And I thought people should start thinking.
At the age of 96, Engelman is still creating art out of her Wisconsin home.
I have made a sewing center here in the bathroom. So I put my sewing machine here.
Some of her art now relates to more tame themes like nursery rhymes.
Mary had a little lamb. Its fleece was white as snow.
But like the bra flag, she continues to create pieces that are politically motivated.
Molly Honkin brought us that story on Marge Engelman's bra flag. The art itself is part of the Wisconsin 101 Project, which tells our state's history through objects. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Now, the U.S. Supreme Court last month agreed to take up a case relating to whether people with domestic violence restraining orders have the right to own guns. The case will land at the Supreme Court in the next term. a federal judge ruled that a 1994 law preventing people with those domestic violence restraining orders goes against, quote, our nation's historical tradition of firearm regulation, end quote. History is at the heart of the case because the Supreme Court ruled in Bruin versus New York that restrictions on guns must be consistent with historical tradition. All this is part of a broader push among conservatives on the court to advance the idea of originalism, a doctrine that argues we have to interpret the Constitution as the founders would have when they were alive. We're talking about this Supreme Court case that will decide whether people with domestic violence restraining orders can be barred from owning guns. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think? Should people with domestic violence restraining orders be allowed to purchase and own firearms? When would it be fair to take away someone's right to own a firearm? What's your reaction to recent U.S. Supreme Court decisions on Second Amendment issues? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Susan Liebel is a professor of political science at St. Joseph's University and an expert on the Second Amendment. Susan, welcome back to the show.
It's a pleasure to be with you, Rob.
All right, a lot of layers here. Let's start with this 1994 law at the center of the case. In a nutshell, what does this federal law do?
It wasn't a nutshell. It was enormous. The Violent Crime Control and Law Enforcement Act of 1994 was just pages and pages of different kinds of measures that were meant to be tough on crime. President Clinton was trying to show that Democrats were tough on crime. And so this included things like 10,000 new police officers and almost $10 billion in funding for prisons. But it also called for a Violence Against Women Act and tried to find ways, including the creation of the National Domestic Violence Hotline and requiring states to enforce restraining orders in other states, to get at violence against women across the country. There was a Safe Streets Act that was part of it as well. So it was a big omnibus crime law, and it also included these protections for women and a little bit more of a focus on things like battered women's shelters.
The part of the law involving saying, hey, if you have this domestic violence restraining order, this federal law prevents you from owning firearms. That's this case now advancing to the Supreme Court. Can you give us a background on this Texas case that is now headed to the Supreme Court?
Yeah, it's really tough. In 2019, a Texas man had an argument with his girlfriend in a parking lot. Mr. Zaki Rahimi knocked the woman to the ground. And as he dragged her back to his car, she hit her head on the car's dashboard. And later in a telephone call, and I think this is really an important fact, Rahimi threatened the woman that he would shoot her if she told anyone about the assault. Now, a few months later, she did get a domestic violence restraining order against Mr. Rahimi. And that barred him, as you said, under that 1994 law, from possessing a gun, and warned him that doing so while the order was in effect would be a federal felony. And about a year later, while that order was still in effect, he was a suspect in a series of shootings. And when the police came in and searched his home pursuant to a warrant, they found a pistol, a rifle, and ammunition with a copy of the restraining order as well. So he was charged with violating the federal ban on the possession of a firearm by anyone who is the subject of a domestic violence restraining order. And he pleaded guilty to that and was sentenced to just over 6 years in prison.
Now, gun laws have changed, or the way the courts view gun laws changed in this Bruin case I mentioned. Can you talk about this standard established by the Supreme Court majority on the historic nature of gun laws and how it applies now to this case making its way through the system and to the Supreme Court?
Of course, Rob. You know, usually these things sound so academic, but this particular case shows how they're not in any way academic. They affect everyday lives across the country, because what happens is the Fifth Circuit does rule on this case. And when the Bruin case comes out, they redo the case with a different answer, which we can get to later. But what the Bruin case said was that rather than asking the question, is there a compelling state interest in regulating guns such that we can ask a gun owner to comply? For example, rules about concealed carry, which was the subject of the Bruin case. And New York State had had a law for 100 years that said you could have concealed carry, but you had to apply for it and have a cause for needing it. What the court said was, we're not going to ask the question, is there a compelling reason? The new question we're going to ask was there a law in either 1791, when the Constitution was passed, or 1868, when another set of framers revised the Constitution after the Civil Law, would one of those two audiences have had a law that is analogous to what New York State has? And if they don't, if they can't find such a law, if the history and tradition of those two time periods, the 18th and 19th century, don't have it, well, then the people of New York State can't pass that law, and so the law that's stood for 100 years in New York was overturned by the Supreme Court.
Now, there's how this clashes with this current case. Domestic violence laws, domestic violence restraining orders, that was not a concept. That wasn't a thing we had, right, in the early days of the Republic. Can you talk about how applying that kind of historic standard to something like domestic violence bring us to where we are?
Yeah, I mean, look, originalism, which is what the justices are using, promises to interrogate the text and be disinterested. It says, like, look, we have this sacred text and we're not imposing our beliefs on it. We're just looking at the past. But I think it's really important for us to remember that this idea of originalism only came about quite recently in the 1980s. And so it's not something that the court has been doing for very long. But this court, the Roberts Court, is very committed to originalism. And the problem with it is that at the time of the founding, 1791, and the revision of the Constitution, in fact, men were very much allowed to beat their wives. In fact, it was their entitlement to be able to coerce them into desired domestic habits, which is a quote from that time period. And the rape of a married woman by a man was not a crime. So, and in fact, the rape of a married woman by a man other than her husband was a property crime of man against man. And this is because in the 18th and 19th centuries, married women and most women had very few rights in the United States. And that means that if we're only looking at analogous laws, we won't find any protecting domestic violence. We'll find the opposite. The history and tradition of the United States until the 1970s is to give men the right, in fact, to coerce their wives by beating them or to rape them. So it's a very tough judicial methodology if you care about violence against women or other groups that were not considered at the time of the two foundings.
We're talking to Susan Liebel, professor of political science at St. Joseph's University, looking at a case that will decide whether people under domestic violence restraining orders have the right to bear arms, and changes in gun law interpretation at the Supreme Court that allowed this case to make it to the nation's highest court. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you're willing to share a story, if you're a survivor of domestic violence or you work with survivors, what do you think of this idea of, you know, banning gun ownership for people with a domestic violence restraining order? What are your thoughts on this case as it heads to the Supreme Court? Join in at 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. Our talk with Susan Liebel, professor of political science at St. Joseph's University, looking at a U.S. Supreme Court case they've decided to take up that will decide whether people under domestic violence restraining orders can be barred from owning firearms. A federal law does just that. It is up for debate now at the court, and you could join in at 800-642-1234. Should it be legal to have laws that bar people with domestic violence restraining orders from having guns. Join in at 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller. Jordan is with us in Stevens Point. Jordan, hi.
Good afternoon.
What did you want to bring up, Jordan?
So if I'm understanding the originalist doctrine correctly, wouldn't that mean that today only white male land-owning citizens would be able to vote? But in all of these other aspects of interpreting the Constitution, it is a living document that can keep up with our day and age. Why is it particular to the Second Amendment that we are anchored to the original ratification of the Constitution?
Jordan, thanks for the call. Susan.
It's a great question. So in terms of the vote, there's an explicit change to the Constitution that happens in 1868, which is adding the 15th Amendment, which says that, in fact, the vote is extended to people, not women, but it is extended to all men in the United States. So that's how originalists would get around that. And then they would point to the amendment of the document again to explicitly include women's voting. So voting isn't the example that would be the strongest, but Jordan's idea is there, that, and it is true, that in all things that are not explicitly stated, there seems to be more room for modernity. But what has happened, and this is only since 2008, and I can't overstate that many conservative people have been on the Supreme Court for 200 years, and they didn't write about originalism. Originalism is something that is very new and only dates to the Reagan 80s and attempts to change a methodology that has existed for a long time. So I think there is, or was before 2008, some sort of shared understanding of that. In 2008, people reread what they had agreed upon previously was something about militias, and they say that it is an individual right that cannot be compromised. And that is very new, Jordan. It goes with this radical originalism that is introduced last year in the Bruin case. So we have sort of the start of the originalist Second Amendment in the Heller case in 2008, and then we see it kind of expand in ways that I think nobody would have imagined, insisting that there be a historical analogy for a law.
And briefly, thanks for that call, Jordan. That's something I wanted to dig into a bit more. We have this, as of last year, this historic standard. We have to establish that there was a comparable law in the early days of the Republic. Does that happen with anything but guns right now? Is that something we do with other constitutionally enumerated rights?
Well, it happened with abortion as well. The abortion case followed that exact kind of approach. And I think we are hearing hints of it in cases that involve LGBTQ people, because, in fact, we have a history and tradition of, in fact, disrespect for LGBTQ people in 1791 and 1868, in which often they are criminalized and not judged to be as citizens. But it honestly, Rob, all the other amendments, First Amendment, there are compromises to the First Amendment. You do not have, as Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes put it, the right to cry fire in a crowded theater. And in fact, we restrict people's speech all of the time. We restrict people in many ways. Something has happened with guns in which the narrative has been that guns equal freedom, and that they're more important than, for example, First Amendment rights to speak. So we see, for example, the clash between First Amendment speech rights and guns. If we want to go to a protest and hold up a sign that says, "I want X," will you feel the same in that crowd if there are people there with guns? Will it, in fact, affect people's First Amendment rights? Will they be more careful about what they say in the public sphere if they think that everybody in the public sphere has a gun?
Time for one more caller. Liz is with us in Lyons. Liz, hello.
Hi.
What did you want to tell us about, Liz?
So in more detail, let's say a police officer has domestic violence However, they're not holding him accountable, and yet he's still able to carry a gun. That would be my situation. More detail in that, I would want to know how can we make those people accountable and keep them from getting a gun through their job?
Liz, thanks for the call. I'm sorry that you are in that situation. First of all, Susan, Liz says, victim of domestic violence, her husband in law enforcement. I guess it illustrates that these are not just academic court issues, as you said earlier. These are things that affect real people.
No, and Liz, I'm very sorry to hear about your situation. What is encouraging is that Congress in 1994 thought about this and listed situations like this as the reason for creating this rule. And I think the thing that's very important for me to communicate is that the majority opinion in the appeals court below really trivializes the kind of experience that Liz is having. Instead, they see Congress as the threat, not the people with guns who are beating people up in a parking lot and threatening them. Judge Wilson foresees the government stripping speeders or people who don't recycle or who drive an electric vehicle of their right to bear arms. And that is really making fun of what the heart of this case is. None of the domestic violence statistics, and they are horrifying, are in this case. I mean, 20% of female intimate partner homicide victims who had restraining orders were killed within 2 days of the order being issued, and 33 were killed within a month. There is a concurrence in this opinion which talks about restraining orders as tactical devices used in divorce proceedings.
I will have to leave it there. Susan Liebel was with us talking about domestic violence and gun rights.